Hi, this is Phil Meeks, author of Dog Boy, Den of Thieves, and this week I'm running a special kind of celebratory promotion on the book. Basically, my birthday is next week, January 1st, and I'd really like to have a few drinks to drink, you know, because it's New Year's Eve, my birthday. So I decided that all of the profits from Dog Boy, Den of Thieves this week will be going to buy me drinks for my birthday. You want to buy me a drink, right? If you want to, you can just go to dogboyadventures.com and click on store, and you can buy it through there, or just go to bit.ly/dogboybook. Again, that's bit.ly/dogboybook, and we'll see you in the funny papers. Enjoy Roberto's show.
Called 8-Bit Life. I'm your host, Roberto Villegas. Joining me, and I'm actually at his place this time, surprisingly enough. Usually I'm in my own house, my own apartment studio, but today I'm on location. I've joined you, joining Chris Nicholas, a.k.a. Uncle Staple, the guy who runs the craziness that is the Staple Convention here in Austin, Texas. How's it going, sir?
It's going well.
We've actually been a weird weather here in Austin.
It has been, yeah.
It's been fucking cold.
It was cold, and then it was cold as shit. and then it was cold. Today was pretty nice. Yeah, it was still kind of chilly.
It's hit freezing a couple times already here. Which, okay, obviously I have some fans in the north. I know I have friends of mine in the north, and I understand that
it's not really cold.
This is not common for Austin to be here at, like, because it got to the point where my office was, you know, afraid of, like, okay, well, if it freezes over, because essentially my office is on the top of a hill over there in the hill country kind of area over there, above, I think, 360, the bridge and whatnot.
Okay.
The fear was that...
Yeah, that bridge will ice over.
Exactly. Yeah, that was one fear. Two, that they just closed the road entirely. And then the last fear was, because it's on the top of the hill, that if everything else worked out and that got iced, it'd just be terrible. So it's been a weird thing of weather. How do you handle, like, speaking of which, Albert, we might get in the interview proper, but I'm curious, how do you handle, like, weather stuff with conventions and things like that? Do you tend to have that ever happen to you? What's the, like, worst thing that's happened before any convention that, like, weather-related?
Weather-related? Since it's indoors,
but let me, like, yeah, but
it's not really.
Well, I know that the indoors
isn't
happening.
Issue. Now, when it has come up, and when it's is like at the after party when we're doing the live art show and we're doing that outdoors.
Oh, okay.
So then, I mean, we haven't had rain, but we've had kind of both extremes of weather, hot and cold. You know, and that has just made people kind of cold and uncomfortable, but I don't know. I think kind of crappy weather is kind of good for conventions, because when it's really super nice out, you know, here in the spring, my show's in the springtime, and, you know, the weather's, you know, it's always dicey. It's usually nice, but, you know, sometimes it might be really cold or it might get pretty warm, but yeah, if it's super nice out, people want to go out and play in the park or whatever.
Totally.
I'd rather them come inside and look at comic books.
Well, so, you know, speaking of which, let's flash back a bit. Let's roll back and explain, because I just jumped right into it, as my style happens to be. But I'm talking, as I said, here with Chris, and Chris actually runs a convention known as Staple. Can you explain, just in the briefest of concept, what the hell is Staple? I mean, especially for those who are not of Austin, who have not, or of Texas even, that have just kind of heard it uttered and muttered, or even heard it's obviously some of my audience is
corners in the back of the
Staple actually is code for the porn festival here in Austin. Right. It's really awesome. Now, what is Staple?
Yeah, we'll put a staple in your dick. No.
Really now?
Let's don't. I mean, you could probably get that
one.
I'm sure you could get that done here.
I'm pretty certain you can.
I'll pass. Staple. We call it Staple, the Independent Media Expo. And it's kind of patterned after an indie comics show, like say SPX or Ape, where it's basically, I mean, if you've been to a mainstream convention and you go into like the artist alley, that's basically the whole show.
Okay, it's so all it's
independent
more
creators, small press dudes, artists of various kinds, some craftspeople.
So it's more geared in terms of, obviously, like at a big giant Comic-Con, we have, or, you know, comic book convention, mm-hmm. we have a lot of vendors, we have a lot of different kind of things going on.
Right.
This is more geared towards, these are the creators of independent content or any kind of, or whatever, you know,
exactly,
comic books,
yeah,
like that.
And, you know, primarily focused on comics, because that's, you know, my main interest. I self-publish comics as well, and that's which kind of led me to starting the convention. But yeah, there's no celebrities really, you know, not media celebrities anyway. Yeah, you know, there's no
Nathan Fillion's. You're
welcome to come.
Joss Whedon, of course, but
if he likes.
That would actually be kind of fun.
I like. He's a nice guy. Seems like. And you know, it's a. We don't really have that. We don't really have like dealers, like you know, the guys that go to, from show to show with 10,000 back issues and stuff like that. I used to call it the stench of 10,000 back issues.
Okay, so you got to explain that. I mean, only because like the stench of. Have you been to many conventions where? I mean, here's the question: what's obviously you've ran your own convention. You've been to. What's the worst convention you've been to? Like, what's like the worst experience you've ever had at a convention? Whether it be because of poor management or just poor experience. I'm just curious now that we talk about conventions.
You put me on the spot. Okay.
I'm sorry for doing that.
That's fine. I would say like those early was the 2000, like 4 or 5 Wizard World conventions in Dallas that they used to have.
Really?
Now, they've been running Austin Comic Con down here. Wizard World, of course, everyone knows is a big corporation that runs conventions. They used to have a magazine.
I always remember Wizard World was like the comic book was like the magazine that like graded like comics and gave you like that. And I remember, if I'm not mistaken, they also I think had a section back in the day for Magic. Either they ran it or no, it was Scry magazine that did Magic the Gathering stuff. I think this is literally my knowledge
nowadays
goes.
They're completely out of the publishing industry altogether, and they just run conventions.
Okay.
And I'd say they've gotten better at it. The Austin Comic Con here has been pretty well run and well attended, and it's not, in fact, yeah, my experience there was before I had done a convention when that first was a role I went to in Arlington, actually. And that kind of gave me a lot of examples of what not to do.
Well, yeah, because that's sort of what happens. So, I mean, obviously, you've now gone into running your own convention and everything else. Mm-hmm. We'll get back to talking about Sable in a second. I just always find it really fascinating when you see things done wrong,
mm-hmm.
and how you take that, especially when you do your own thing. Because I've been in conventions where I'm like, this has got to be the hardest thing to run. This has got to be the – well, because it's not so much that you're dealing with – I mean, thankfully, yours is more artist gear, you know, artist oriented. So you're not dealing with vendors. You're not dealing with a whole bunch of people selling a lot of different wares. But you're still dealing with, you know, making sure everyone is placed where they want to be, making sure everyone's happy, making sure guests are happy. Like, what is the biggest challenge that you'd say in terms of running Staple? I mean, even though it's a smaller convention, you still have challenges and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a lot of work, and it's just what I like call herding cats. It's kind of, you know, we're an all volunteer group that runs it, and we're you know, just kind of getting. But my main job of being in charge of it seems to be just sending out emails to people and telling, you know, coordinating information, and then you know, getting people to do what, you know, they say they're going to do,
getting people to do what they say. That's got to be the hard.
You know,
I mean,
that's just like, just, you know, just kind of, you know, try to keep positive attitude when things don't.
Well, yeah, because
work out,
you have, because if you're the guy running it, I mean, no matter how, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously it's volunteer run. Most of them are never, except for like your big Wizard World ones and your Comic Cons. Most of the time they're just volunteers running, especially if you've ever been to an anime convention, usually all the guys there are volunteers who are just there for like a comp badge or two. Heck, even South right. by has volunteers, to put that in perspective. Yeah. And so ultimately, when it comes to those things, especially when you're the smaller you are, you're essentially, hey, can I call a favor here? Can I ask you that? Are you sure you're not? And it gets difficult because some people think of it almost not like a job. Like they take it as a, well, I'm just doing this as a favor. It's totally cool. Yeah, I can slack off. Yeah. But to you, it's important. It's a job. I mean, do you tend to view it that way as like almost as a not a year long job per se, or but.
Well, it's almost year long. I'm at least always thinking about it.
I mean, yeah, when do you really start planning for this whole thing? Like, how early in the year?
It's kind of always in mind, and I'm always looking out for any opportunities, you know, to enhance it or get a guest or whatever. But the serious planning, I mean, the show's in March, first week in March. It'll be March 1st and 2nd, 2014.
You got that spiel down, Pat. Out there.
And, yeah, we usually, like, August. Like, we usually really start trying to nail stuff down in August. And, like I say, like, with my committee that helps me do it is all volunteer, and I have to coordinate around their schedules.
Right, of course.
To, you know, get kind of, because I can't do 100% of the work. You know, there's some things that I have to get other people to do. So, you know, I like to leave enough leeway, enough time for everybody to be.
Well, yeah, because you want to throw a good, you want to throw a good convention, no matter what.
You can never, and with any big endeavor, really, you can never start planning too early.
I imagine, no, of course not. I mean, especially for that, because you have to worry.
You can never plan too much. You really can't.
Well, because it's not just so much worry about other people's schedules and booking guests. It's also booking venues, making sure there's space, figuring out how much space you need, how you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
What's the biggest variable you think in terms of that? Is it more the space, or is it booking guests?
The way we've been doing it, it started really small, been growing it conservatively over the years. I never wanted it to outgrow its audience, which I feel like there's some of the bigger sort of indie conventions may have outgrown their audience. What I mean by that is the way I perceive the convention, one of my main customer really is the exhibitor, or the person who's actually purchasing the table to get the set up there. They need to have a good experience. They need to sell stuff,
right,
in order for them to come back the next year.
Right, because the idea behind these conventions is exposure and selling product and things like that.
Right, and you know, I'm all about supporting the independent artists.
Right,
and,
of course,
and sort of raising awareness of that kind of stuff. So it's like, when you're growing it, you don't want to, if more or less, after a couple of years, you kind of get an idea more or less how many people are going to show up to it. So you don't want to make it so much bigger that those people they're spending dollars are too spread out. You know what I mean? Over too many tables or whatever. So we've actually, finding good venues for this size of an event has been a pretty big challenge in Austin. And I think, we started like at the Elks Lodge, so it was very small. One room, about 29, 28 tables or something like that. Then we moved it over to another venue, and they're ballroom, and then they had like extra room, so we could, the following year, we could kind of expand out a little more. And then after the year after that, we were going to go back, but then this place was at North Cross Mall, and North Cross Mall got knocked down, so
right,
the venue wasn't going to be there anymore, so we had to move it. And so we moved it over to the Monarch, which is now the Marquesa.
Okay, I didn't realize that had a previous name.
Yeah, it had been the Monarch. I mean, it was a long time ago. It was the Lincoln Village Cinema,
right?
The old Lincoln Village Shopping Center over there. And it was a fit, but then we actually, so we bumped the size up a little bit when we moved in there. but then we couldn't expand anymore, and there weren't any other, it wasn't a venue that was, say, 15-20% bigger.
Right, because, in terms of Austin, for those who've never obviously been in this town, the two major venue areas, like we're talking like the big giant ones, are, of course, the Austin Convention Center downtown and the Palmer Event Center. Mm-hmm. After that, things are from my understanding, are very much, well, there's space here, but that's not that's super small. And there's space here, but that's a little too big. Like the Palmer is sort of that only one I can think of. That's even huge.
It's a bit, yeah. It's a bit, well, yeah, like, I guess Marquesa is like maybe about 15,000 square feet tall.
Yeah, something like that.
And then the next thing up is like 50.
Jesus.
Yeah. It's like you can get like a chunk of Palmer. You can get like a room, one of those rooms at the convention center, which, by the way, are ludicrously expensive.
Yeah. No. It's funny you bring that up. One of the previous conventions I was at recently was the Classic Game Fest that was there, ran by the guys from Game Over Games. And they got a little, like, I didn't realize there was a second floor of the Palmer. I had no idea until like that day. Because every time I'd been there, it'd been just for South by stuff, so they take up the whole damn floor and things like that. I never knew that there was like, go up the stairs and there's these other little ballrooms.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, wow, this is perfect. But they sold out. They had a big space too. That almost looked small. I'll be honest, that was actually smaller than the Marquesa, tells you, at least in my perception of knowing that theater and how big it is and how that stuff. How does running, when it comes to convention, the panel side of thing go? Now that we've kind of established space and things like that, like how do you book guests for those sort of things?
We try to book a couple of good indie, comic book guests with some indie cred, but who've kind of made local boys make good, so to speak. Not necessarily local, but.
Titans of the indie scene.
Yeah, so we've had folks that have come up from the ranks, and they're, like Gay Davis, and we had, Kevin Eastman. We've had, Stan Sakai, who's kind of the godfather of, indie comics. He's been doing that stuff for so long. But other kind of like up-and-coming guys, too, are hot, and we try to get those guys as guests, and then or ladies, and then they'll do a Q&A, but then we always try to provide some more programming that we think other people will find interesting, that's still with it, we feel like is in our purview. Like we've had a podcasting panel, we've had a web TV panel, we've had, because that's a form of the full name of the convention is, by the way, I don't know if I said, is Staple the Independent Media.
Yeah, you mentioned the independent media part. I want to because ultimately, with a convention that goes, all around, sometimes you get to a point where you start to lose a focus of some sort. Where do you draw the line in terms of media? Because media it doesn't just mean comics. Obviously, it means video, audio, and things like that. Like where do you say, all right, not because I don't like you guys or don't think you're great, but we need to make sure that this convention focuses on these core things. Like, where do you draw that line of that where we just – not because we won't touch it because it's not good, but just we're not the best place for that.
Yeah, well, no, that's a good question. I think – I've never – tried to said here's a definite line, we don't do this, but I think the type of event it is more geared towards people who are actually creating physical objects.
Okay,
so it could be a comic book, could be a zine, could be a plush toy,
something you can touch and feel, and if a person walks by, well,
because the way it's set up, we have 83 8-foot tables out there, people set up stuff. So wouldn't fit as well as, say, film. Somebody who has a selling a movie, you know, selling their indie film or, you know, music, for instance.
Right.
But I also feel like both those are already really well represented in the
right.
town.
Right. No, that's what I'm
events,
saying. Is
you know?
That where,
so,
you know.
So, whereas this other stuff, you know, comics specifically, because, you know, it's my main focus, but, and then things kind of related to that aren't. Is represented.
How did you get into indie comics in the first place? Specifically, you mentioned this whole self-publishing thing. How the heck did you get into that? Like, what?
Why?
Maybe that's what we should be. Maybe we should start talking about the birth of Staple, because you had mentioned that there are other independent conventions and things like that, and you mentioned that you got into it because you self-publish.
Yeah.
Where did all this begin? Let's turn back time.
Turn back the Wayback Machine. Back in the days long ago.
Let's turn on our let's not even know a good time.
We had these things called comic books. There were pictures and words on the same page.
Oh my god! But yeah, so how did you get into all the independent side? I mean, obviously everyone's really familiar with the more, I'm putting in air quotes, commercial side of things, that being your Marvel and DC.
Sure, yeah.
But there's a whole bunch of things that have become independent. I mean, that are, you know.
Well, I mean,
this is big.
For me personally, I mean, I grew up reading comics as, you know, a kid, and I still love comics, and I love superhero comics. You know, I still like, I don't read as much of them. My taste kind of changed about the time I started going to college, and I became less enchanted with superhero comics and more interested in, this was the 80s, I'm old.
It's okay.
Some of the
what was the turning point
titles that were coming out around then? I think you know, for instance, like Hellblazer. It was Vertigo. I guess it was kind of an offshoot of DC. So but it wasn't superhero stuff. You know, it was
horror.
But there's things like The Tick and Milk and Cheese, and you know, a lot of the stuff in the late 80s, early 90s, sort of indie stuff got me interested in comics is stuff, you know. I kind of realized that people could do stuff that wasn't superhero stuff.
And that's interesting. You bring up The Tick, because even like with me, my introduction to The Tick obviously was, you know, in terms of my age demographic, was the cartoon show. Mm-hmm. And I think about that, you know, in hindsight now, what you're mentioning them as in the 80s being these independent kind of properties, these sort of things that were just whatever. And even things I think of other comic books that I've known that become more properties in my mind, like the Sam and Max comics, would then become a video game, a LucasArts game that would be a big thing. And of the Tick would become not only a cartoon show that was beloved by my generation, but also a live-action show.
Right.
And so, you know, you bring up a lot of these sort of things that were independent that are now.
A lot of things. Yeah, those are probably just the more well-known examples of that kind of stuff that, like you say, they went on and fostered. Yeah, well, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
That was its own self-published comic. Exactly, about to say, yeah, started off as a comic, but an independent comic as well.
So it's already understood that, you know, you could do that sort of thing, and then I don't know, really just bored me and my buddy. My friend that I make comics with, David G. Lamplew, the fine artist here in town, he had done a comic. He wrote, drew, lettered, you know, penciled ink, lettered,
did all that
the
stuff.
Whole thing of this, this like 88-page graphic novel, 80-page, and then essentially, like, stuck under his futon. That was the end of it. The Bristol boards piling up under his futon.
And that was the end. That was the end of it.
Well, yeah. Well,
obviously not.
That was chapter one in that story. But then, I don't know. Then he started kind of working on some other stuff, and then he came up. He had this kind of little germ of an idea for a comic, and asked me to help him write it. And yeah, we basically over a summer, we sat down at Mojo's, the old Mojo's coffee shop. It's not there anymore.
Right.
Sat on their porch and smoked and drank coffee and bullshitted, which we would have done ordinarily. But in the, with
by this time, you're also drawing and writing. We took notes of what the hell you're talking about.
Like, we bullshitted about the same thing for about 3 months. Anyway, yeah, so we wrote, we kind of wrote a script for this comic, and then we just started making the comic book and printing it up at the copy shop that he worked next to, where we had a friend.
So basically calling in favor upon favor upon favor to get this thing done.
That's what you got to do. And so we get that, we get that first issue done right before that first Wizard World show. And we went up there. That was also the year Dark Horse was doing a thing where you submit, and I think they did that one time, and like, this is horrible, we'll never do this again. You submit an idea, or like, they were taking open, Dark Horse was taking open submission.
That seems so bizarre.
And they had a booth set up at Wizard World, and you could drop your submission off with them.
Okay, here's a question for you, and not because
we dropped it off, and we did get a really nice rejection letter, which I have framed.
That's great. Here's a question. All right, obviously you guys submitted something great, whatever. Yeah. How many? Let's say this. How many of the submissions do you think were adult natured?
Oh dear.
Like, if you were to venture a guess, and only because, like, if you, and again, it's not to say that there's nothing wrong with adult, when I say adult natured, I mean, like, yeah, like, we're talking, you know.
Furry porn.
Exactly. You got it.
Yeah, furry porn and stuff like that.
Because, like, that's the danger, I would imagine, running, like, an open submission just letting anybody come on in, like, I got this great idea for Batman and Batgirl, and they're boning over and over and over, and they just drop, like, a dome.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm.
Yeah, sort of slash fic written. I wouldn't guess venture to guess a percentage, but it was high enough. They never did it again. They never held open submissions.
Because that's why. Because it's not to say that it's a bad thing about independent comics. There's always great. But when you are Dark Horse, like, imagine if DC did that. Like, if DC, like, said, you just shook it. Cause...
Well, they kind of did that, didn't they? Were like,
did they?
Send us your drawing of... choking to death in the bathtub.
Oh yeah, that's right. They had the Harley Quinn doing that. I think Harley Quinn doing some crazy thing.
I'll tell you my Dan DiDio story.
Go for it. Tell it. What you're doing? Take a sip of your coffee because I want to hear the story now.
I'm holding that one. I'll hold on to that one.
Oh, come on.
Later. No, we'll tell it.
Okay.
I want to finish it. I've still got this.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So we
had our comic book.
Comic book.
We had
submission.
20-page. It was a crime noir.
What was it about exactly?
Crime noir. It's called You Chose Right the First Time. It's a classic crime noir set in late 60s Chicago.
Oh, interesting.
It's the backdrop of the DNC riots.
Oh, wow.
It's got kind of gangsters. Mobsters, malls, murder and mayhem.
Yeah.
It's also it's a tale of greed, betrayal, psychosis. It
sounds like you're a good noir story in the making.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, it's kind of, you know, that's a genre that both me and Dave really dig. You know, and so in fact, as we made the comic, our kind of ritual was like. When we go get a new issue printed, we take it home and we'd have a stapling party. We'd have some people over, get some beers. We'd throw on a noir movie and we'd sit there because we staple all these.
Right, because for those who've never looked at your comic books or any magazine for that matter, specifically a lot of your more stapled ones, you'll notice that, if I'm not mistaken, the way printed is, like, the inner page is the only one that matches and it sort of does this sort of off-pairing thing because you just... I can try to think. I'm thinking. If you ever look at a magazine, you'll see what I mean.
Well, yeah. Well, like most professionally,
they're bound
printed,
in some way.
They're what's called saddle stitched.
Okay.
Which looks like a staple, but it's basically a giant sewing machine that sews with thread of metal.
Oh, interesting. So, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I always wonder what the heck Saddle Stitch was. I've always wondered about that.
It functions essentially like a staple, but it's not a staple. It's just that I had an opportunity to buy a really old one of those recently, but I didn't ever put it. But yeah, it's like if you ever see one, there's like a spool. It looks like a spool of thread,
but it's metal.
But it's steel, yeah.
Okay.
And then there's this big arm that, you know, punches it into the paper and clips it off. So it basically sews a staple into it.
Yeah, because like I'm only like if any kind of binding, cool. I'm looked, you know, used to like the glue and the book bindings, but never right. that. I've always heard saddle stitch. I've always wondered what the heck that was.
Yeah, and you could buy a stapler. It's called a saddle stitch stapler. It's not really a saddle stitcher. It's just a stapler. I've got a longer. Long arm stapler.
I'm gonna have to look.
Can you pause while I
go? you go grab it. Go grab it. I'll vamp for a bit to the audience, because this is so super fascinating to me. Because I rarely get to see all these kind of weird binding things. Like I think about my head of that because I know a lot of people out there who are listening to the show are kind of content people. Some of you guys are writers. Some of you guys are not writers, and so. A lot of you guys are also independent stuff, and you know me as independent podcast. Jesus Christ on a crutch! I am. I'll describe what I'm looking at right now. It's a Swingline brand with a. What the hell?
That's what you call a long arm stapler.
All right, explain why I need a long arm stapler for anything.
Well, you need a long arm stapler is basically to make comic books. So, as you could tell, it's got a.
Yeah, it's got a bit of an arm to it.
It's got an arm. It's deep. It's got a deep. It's got a.
Imagine, if you will,
ruler.
A stapler attached to a giant ruler.
Yeah, so
that's
it's like
best
a stapler.
Way to explain it.
Exactly right. It's a stapler on the end of a ruler, and yeah, you can see, you know, it goes up to 12. Well, it goes past 12 inches, but it's measured up to 12 inches, and then you have this little guide. So, like that comic book on the
right.
on the couch there. Is one I made. I printed it on 8.5 by 11 paper, so the center of that 11 is 5.5 inches. So I set the guide to 5.5 inches, and then I put the piece of paper in because you can't do that with a normal stapler.
Right, exactly.
So you put the guide. So you put it in, and then you put the staple in. It puts the staple more or less in the right spot.
Do you find it harder, especially now? I mean, now in the independent comic world and the comic world in general.
One of these is about $30.
Yeah. Well, here's a question. Do you find it easier or harder now to produce independent content or comic books in this case? But and the reason I ask that is because, I mean, with things like Comixology, things with like the iPad and digital comics kind of coming into their own, both independent and otherwise – do you find it easier to be put content out there now than it was before?
Well, I think certainly if you're going to go digital, you just have to learn the technology and then you can push the stuff out there and you don't have to sit around and staple things. I personally like things to read long format comics on paper. I mean, people have been doing web comics now since the 90s.
Oh yeah, I mean we've had things like Penny Arcade, PvP, Control and, Delete, that kind of things.
Several people make their living doing comics. So and you know what's nice about we've had a few web comics panels. I'd say we're kind of putting one together for next year as well.
Oh really? That's cool.
I think. Thing about webcomics, it's nice is once you own a computer and you get a domain name, you spend $20 maybe, and then you learn how to build a website. You've basically that's all you have to do.
Well,
buy paper,
right?
You don't have to, and you can do color, and it's not more expensive.
but even now, I mean, with
now,
things like
whether people will see it or not,
that's a good point. Yeah.
It is another matter.
But even now, in terms of printing, here's a question. Comparing what you did during the 80s and sort of this, you getting in at that point to now in terms of printing, do you find – what has been the biggest advancement that has helped you produce independent – I mean, because obviously the trick when it comes to comic books – that was always, mm-hmm. you know, the barrier of entry was the printing, was the production.
I would say that if you're self-publishing, that's certainly a barrier still. It's still expensive. Even, if you go online, you get these print-on-demand places.
Right.
They're still very expensive. I mean, you can kind of, I don't know, not print it till you sell it, but then I don't know. I'm not sure how that works. My approach has always been maybe a little more old school, but it's just go print the stuff and then take it to a show or something like that.
Right. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. It is more of a. I mean, obviously, put it this way. Did you ever think in a position, you know, if obviously in the 80s you had a certain idea, did you ever think even – I guess the question is this. Back then, did you ever think you would be running a convention geared towards independent?
I started reading indie comics.
Okay, yeah. When did you start making indie comics?
I didn't start making indie comics until about 2004.
Well, it's still been 12 years, but you know, if we take that idea of it's right now 2013, that's about 9 years ago. When did you start Staple? What was the first year?
2005.
Oh Jesus. Okay. Wow. You just jumped right into it.
Get right on that pony, man.
I
started like the first comic we probably started making it in 2003, we got it out in time for the first Wizard World, which was 2004.
Right.
We went there.
Did the Dark Horse thing.
We went there. Yeah, we did the Dark Horse thing. And we just like, we didn't have a table or anything.
Right.
We just had the one comic book, which we were selling for $1. We basically printed for free.
Right, exactly.
We stole. And so we were just kind of walking. We didn't know what the hell we were doing. We were just walking around the convention, walking up to people. We're giving people and say, hey,
take this.
This is $1.
Give us $1.
Most people give you $1 and get out of their face. Actually, I felt like our best audience was we go out for cigarettes and among the smokers because they're going to be standing there for at least as long as it takes them to smoke.
Right. And you can talk with them, chat them up. Exactly. Explain what your comic's about.
Sold stuff out there. But, that show was seminal. It was a watershed experience for a number of reasons. It was like, A, you're figuring out, how do you sell a comic? B, seeing a convention where the artist alley was so ghettoized.
Yeah.
And the artists were so shat upon that it made me really feel like it really gave me some drive to want to see something done better.
Okay,
How was it at Wizard World?
Yeah, how was it at, like, obviously you guys do some different.
That year, that was back then Wizard World still had porn stars. Amongst the artists, comic books, Jenna Jameson sitting next to Lou Ferrigno or whatever.
that sounds like a movie waiting to happen.
That's, I fix your plumbing.
I think that might be what Lou needs to do next, as opposed to charging $200 for signatures and shit. I think I'd rather see that than
I wouldn't watch it, but
I'd watch it. I'd watch it at least once. I may not necessarily own it, but I sure as hell watch it at least once, just once.
And then the artist alley part of that first show. It was crammed. It was way in the back, crammed in a corner. The aisles were about six and a half feet wide. Two comic book fans could not walk abreast down that aisle.
They basically just set up a spare room and like you guys go in here. And
it was all in one big. The whole convention was all in one big room.
Okay,
but they had squished Artist Alley in the corner so far that you really could not walk down it. I mean, and the people were down there, they were miserable. They couldn't, no one could get down there to buy stuff from them. It was really awful. So the following year, they did put it in another room. They put it in a separate room way down the hall without any signage.
So no one knew where it was.
No one knew where it was. So it was basically like, to me at that time anyway, and I will say, everybody talks crap on Wizard World. I certainly have done it myself. The way they do the artist alley to Chicago Gun, still in the back of the room, but at least you could, there's room.
Yeah, there's a lot of space. Yeah, they basically, for those who have never been to the
comfortable.
Yeah, who's never been to the Austin Convention Center, they essentially take up the space for Wizard World that the South by Southwest vendor / trade show area is. Okay. They take up this like giant space at the bottom.
Yeah,
and they fill it with vendors and artists. And I had a pretty easy way of navigating there. Like I found the artist area too, and found some really cool digital artwork people and things like that. Very effectively, it wasn't that hard at all. But in the past, they just essentially sounded like shit
they
on
really
it.
Care. It was crap. You know, it was obviously not the focus of what they were trying to do.
And so then, okay, obviously you take this knowledge, you go like, no, this is not
this
right.
This is wrong. And the other part of that first show, you know, besides the sort of negative reaction to that, was the positive was I met a lot of other people up there. A couple people from Austin, who John Rubio and a couple other guys who do were running Austin Sketch Group or had founded Austin Sketch Group
right
at that time. And then and so when we got back to town, I started hanging out at Austin Sketch Group, and I met a lot of other local cartoonists, like people. There was other people who were self-publishing comics.
Right, so you're starting.
Me and Dave weren't the only ones.
Yeah, you're trying to find your crew of people.
There was like a community for this stuff, and we would go to some other events around the state, and I met people in Houston and Dallas and San Antonio, and just people from all around the state who were basically doing the same thing I was trying to do, self-published comic and get it out there somewhere. And that's the other thing. So okay, the two sticking, but when you're self-publishing comic, what's gonna hurt you, or how do I put this, the obstacle, main obstacles are A, printing, it's
right,
expensive. B is distribution. Distribution of comic books is controlled by one company in the United States.
Yeah, who is that company? I always forget.
It's not Wizard. It sounds like Wizard.
It's Diamond. Diamond something. Yeah, Diamond or whatever the hell.
So Diamond will only put you in their catalog if they think they're going to sell X number. And several years ago, they raised that bar too. So it was like 1,000 or 2,000 copies. Before they'll even put you in the catalog.
This is not something I've always wondered. How do comic book stores deal with that?
They don't like it.
Because, I would imagine I would hate that. I mean, especially if it's like this is the only. I mean, because I think about now of, you know, one of the biggest comic book things that happened in the past couple of years that was independent I can think of was Scott Pilgrim versus the World, mm-hmm. which produced the whole goddamn movie. And that was a web comic, independent kind of thing done by this, Canadian. If I remember,
I don't know if it had been a web comic.
Had a web presence.
Came out on Oni Press,
right? Right,
which is a respectable, decent sized indie house.
Fair enough, but still indie nonetheless. You know, it's not like a DC or Marvel kind of thing,
right?
But I think about it in my head of those sort of things that have become what they are now. These sort of cultural crazy things,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of them if we were mentioning the big ones earlier, like Tick and things like that, were started indie. So I always found it kind of odd that comic books had this like weird barrier of distribution of like this one conglomerate kind of thing.
Yeah, and like earlier on, I guess in the 80s, it was a little easier. There's like a couple of small indie distributors,
right?
But they don't get out. I think Colcut and another one, that there's this dude that literally drives from town to town selling comics out of his car.
Wow.
Yeah. Tiny Shelton.
That doesn't sound shady at all.
No, he's for real deal. I've never met the guy, but I've heard legends.
Okay, so obviously,
anyway, but yeah, distribution. So you're making this comic. Really, the only way you're going to get in somebody's hands is A, will your local comic shop stock it?
Right.
They buy it from you or put it on consignment. B is you have to go to a convention and get a table and sell it, direct to consumer.
Right, basically, you know, and this is this what birthed the idea for Staple? Was this whole absence of there being something for independent self publishing guys to go to here?
Precisely. I mean, so what, you know, at that time in 2004, 2005, there was a handful of conventions in the United States that focused on indie creators that, you know, weren't a Wizard World type show, or they weren't a mainstream type convention, where it was, you know, basically, like I say, a big artist alley, where it's the people that are sitting there behind the table selling you that thing have made that thing. And they were in San Francisco, Portland, New York, Maryland, and Ohio. That was it. That's five
areas.
And all, you'll notice if you look at them, very far flung from Texas.
Yeah.
So basically, yeah, you would have to fly there or drive there and get a hotel room.
Yep.
Unless you could find somebody to crash with. And then you buy a table. And so, you know, you're down maybe a grand already.
Right, yeah, the barrier to entry is already a grand, and that's not even assuming you're going to actually sell anything
or get any kind of traction.
Yeah,
that's before you sell anything. And then, you know, you've already paid to print your comics, so, you know, you can factor that in. And then you're selling your, you know, if it's your first comic, your first little mini comic, you're selling for $1 or $2.
Yeah.
Essentially, you're going to lose your ass. You're not going to make any money.
Right, exactly.
You're not going to break even. So when I started meeting other people around town that were, you know, doing that, and some of them had been, my buddy Toby Craig, who lives in Houston, he'd been already self-publishing and going to shows for years at that point. Yeah, he was one of the guys I met when I went on a trip to Houston. But so it was like, there's enough talent, and I was like looking at these people's comics, and they're good.
Yeah, you're just staring at a sea of talent here in Austin.
Yeah, there's
and
no
knowing
people
that,
right here.
Man,
in
these
town.
Guys would totally get traction if they just had someplace to go.
Exactly. You know, so what? You know, let's sweep out the barn and put on a show. we did it. You know, it's like, let's just decide to do this and do this. And, you know, just figure out, you know, it took about a year to plan that first show.
Right.
Between, you know, 2004 and 2005, and then, yeah, March of 2005, it launched.
When it started expanding, like, what year or what incarnation of Staple, because obviously we started in 2005, we're now 2013. When did it start expanding into the other forms of independent meetings? I know you've mentioned to me off the show that there's been independent game developers there. Mm-hmm. There's been some actually big ones kind of premiered premiered at Staple, but talked about at Staple, some of the bigger guys in the indie scene. I mean, in terms of the Austin scene, but definitely getting more and more traction outside the Austin scene for indie stuff.
I mean,
when did that part start coming in? Into like, when did you basically go, all right, not to say comic books are bad, it's not to say that, but when did you start
just opening
branching?
I think we've always been open to other forms. That's why we made the conscious decision to call it, you know, instead of calling Staple the comic book show, we call it Staple the Independent Media Expo. So the impetus to include any sort of form of DIY creativity has always been there. In terms of specifically games, we just, you know, we'd done a panel a few years ago that was just basically a real general DIY panel. So it was, we had one indie game designer on there, that we had a comic book guy, we had a dude that self-publishes a magazine, and a podcaster. So, you know, and they all just sort of
explained the idea of making a
damn thing, you know, and just, you know, pick what you want to do and do that. But so, you know, then in recent years, we just sort of made more effort to reach out to the indie game design guys and encourage them to come in, just, you know, just to get more variety of stuff in there. And I mean, we've always been open to that. I don't know, it's just more of a more that they had to come find us,
right because I mean your guys' primary focus had been comic books and like that,
and that's the other thing with designing the panels and the programming. We always try to keep it fresh and do something new with the programming, so it's not the same stuff every time.
Do you find that the biggest challenge is to figure out what to do each year? Like, do you go back previous years and see what you've done before and say, well, that kind of worked, that didn't work at all, or what if we tweak this? Like, how do you go about, at the beginning of August when you start planning, where do you go, all right, it's panel time, what do we want to do? Do you take suggestions from...
Sure, the committee members will suggest things, people off the street will suggest things to me. I would like to see something like this. Right now, I think I mentioned we're putting together another indie game design panel, and that basically was spawned out of a suggestion from a friend of mine at work. Suggested I try to get this one guy, which I couldn't get, but then I wound up sort of talking to another friend of mine who works in the gaming, has worked in the gaming industry and does now, and say, hey, let's do an indie game design panel.
Well, yeah, because here in Austin, that's starting to become...
It's getting bigger and bigger here in town, and certainly want to include those people in it. We want to. Let me get a little philosophical on your ass.
Oh, go for it. I'm ready.
So staple, the word staple has many layers of meanings, like an onion, if you will. maybe it won't make you cry. So, if you've made a comic book or a zine, you're very familiar with the office product known as a staple.
Correct.
We're using staple in the imperative verb form as an exhortation to create. Hey, you staple, like get to work, make a thing,
right?
Do something. But then is also what does a staple do?
It puts things together.
And that's the whole purpose, is to bring people together, bring the creators of stuff together with their potential consumers of their these things, these fine things.
Well, yeah, that's what I like about the idea of it being focused on independent media, independent comic, almost independent content, because as a kind of an indie podcaster, I find that very appealing. As a guy that's into indie video games, indie comics, and sort of these indie sort of things going on, I find that very fascinating. That we're almost out of time, but you had mentioned you had a story to tell.
Oh,
and I didn't want to see if I want to make sure that I get this, because you said we'll talk about it later, and sometimes it will happen to the show where things will get lost on the side of the road.
It's
if you need to change the names to protect the innocent, by all means, feel free to.
So like I rode up to a Wizard World show,
right,
with some friends, one of whom was a writer for DC at that time, and he had gotten a different writer for DC had failed to produce a script. And so they called this guy up and said, hey, we need a script for this book. Can you do it this weekend? And so he basically saved their bacon on this project.
Right.
And so we got up there and a couple dudes from DC were there, including Dan DiDio. And so they were kissing this guy's ass hard.
Because he just saved the script.
And he was getting the royal treatment, and so he wound up going out to dinner. There was a big dinner that night that's Mexican restaurant that all these guys wanted to go to, and DC was paying for it, and we kind of wound up being his entourage. three of us there was two tables full of people that all went out to dinner on DC's dime that night. One of the DC reps sat at one table with that group of people, and then Dan DiDio sat at our table with our group of people, and basically kind of held court, will. And the other guys I was with, they were writers, and it was very interesting for them. They kind of got the inside scoop on the DC bullpen and how they go about doing or did go about doing stuff at that time. And then, I was just enjoying it and the free margaritas and the nachos and stuff.
Of course.
And then actually, I can't remember how it came up, but I wound up had a couple margaritas in me, so I wound up giving Dan DiDio a raft of shit for canceling Gotham Central. That's the only fucking book y'all put out that I read, and y'all canceled it.
I'm just laughing because, like, there is probably every comic book fan that's listening wishes they could talk to, like, the head of whatever, whether it be Marvel or DC, and just say, you piece of shit, why'd you cancel my favorite run?
Yeah.
And here you are.
Doing it.
Pretty much, like you're already buzzed, at least. You're I got liquid courage running through you. You just do it.
Yeah.
And what do you say?
His response was essentially like, yeah, it was basically you and two other old guys that were buying it. It's like, you dick. It was a good comeback.
It's like, yeah, you son of a bitch. Like, yeah, I'd make it if other people bought it.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Oh, that's great.
Basically, yeah, kind of said it wasn't selling and you're old.
Oh, man. That's a sad note to end on, but we are completely out of time. But, Chris, thank you so much for being on.
Man.
Well, tell people where they can find that information at Staples, especially if they're like either A in Texas or B.
Let me do the big plug here. It's Staple Independent Media Expo. March 1 and 2, 2014, staple-austin.org. We're also on the Facebook Staple Austin. We've got some of our guests lined up. I had mentioned, we're going to do an indie gaming panel, probably a web comics panel, maybe an all ages panel. It would be kind of neat. I've got a couple people in mind for that. We do have Francesco Francavilla coming out. He's been doing Black Beetle, which I just read. It's pretty awesome.
Right.
And the Archie Zombie book.
Oh, interesting. I heard about that. A friend of mine told me about that. That sounds like the most awesome concept ever.
Yeah. And then Chip Zdarsky, who I've actually been a fan of this guy for a long time, but right now he's the artist on Sex Criminals.
Okay.
With Matt Fraction, which got voted by Time Magazine as the number one comic book of 2013.
Wow.
You read the Time Magazine.
No, but that's still important. That's still a big, I mean, that's still kind of a big deal. I mean, you know.
It's been selling out. I've only been able to find like the third printing of the first issue. And I got Randy Lander's last copy of that at Rogues Gallery, one of our sponsors. read it. It's an awesome book. So Chip will be there. And. Lots of fun, good times, and approximately 150 exhibitors of comics, zines, arts, craft, games.
All independent, more. All self-published, all awesome.
Oh, yes, indeed. Did find out, I met Rob Harrell at Wizard World this year, Austin Comic Con, and he puts out a book called... something. Oh shit! I just read it and it's really good.
I guess we'll find out the title, but really, really, really quick. I'll give my ending spiel. Hold on, we got the book title. It's so
Monster on the Hill, which is a great all ages book.
Oh, interesting.
It's out on Top Shelf. Rob lives here in town, so I discovered he's going to be at Staples. So,
that's fucking awesome.
Yeah, he's got blurbs from Neil Gaiman and Jeff Smith on the back of that.
So there you go. He's a heavy hitter.
And it's a cool, good book.
Oh, that's kind of cool. I'll have to check that out more.
Yeah, I recommend it. And
so that's Staple. Of course,
bring it out. And it's a party all weekend. We do a live art show. We do pre parties and after parties and party down.
Fun time should be had by all. Of course. Well, thanks for getting it, Chris. Of course, you can find me. I'm at Vincent404 on the Twitters. If you want to comment on this episode, want to talk about your convention stories, maybe you want to, eventually put a booth there at Staple your own, go to our website, cosplay.tv/8bitlife. There you find links to the show notes, the previous episodes, and, of course, everything that revolves around this 8-bit world of mine and my other shows, such as Jump Point, my kind of gaming show we're talking about with Bryce about more of the in-depth topics in gaming. So that's the show for today. Tune in next week to talk about something completely and utterly random. Bye, people.
Bye-bye.